Chapter 28. The Iceberg Cometh. The Earth has been a giant snowball on many occasions. It was a snowball 2.7 billion years ago, 2.2 billion years ago, and 2 billion years ago. It was a really cold snowball 700 million years ago, and this was followed by a series of global cold snaps that lasted until 600 million years ago. It reverted to snowball mode 300 million years ago, and has been that way on and off for most of the last 50 million years. Ice has played a significant part in the story of life. Just how significant a part, we are now beginning to appreciate. We first began to realize this when we found evidence of the most recent snowball. About 1.5 million years ago, round about the time that humans began to become the dominant species on Earth, the planet got very cold. The old name for this period was the Ice Age. We don't call it that anymore, because it wasn't one age. We talk of the glacial-interglacial cycles. Is there a connection? Did the cold climate drive the naked ape to evolve enough intelligence to kill other animals and use their fur to keep warm? To discover and use fire? This used to be a popular theory. It's possible, but probably not, though. There are too many holes in the logic. But a much earlier and much more severe ice age very nearly put a stop to the whole of that life nonsense. And ironically, its failure to do so may have unleashed the full diversity of life as we now know it. Thanks to the pioneering insights of Louise Agassiz, Victorian scientists knew that the Earth had once been a lot colder than it is now, because they could see the evidence all around them in the form of the shapes of valleys. In many parts of the world today, you can find glaciers, huge rivers of ice, which flow very slowly under the pressure of new ice forming further uphill. Glaciers carry large quantities of rock, and they gouge and grind their way along, forming valleys whose cross-section is shaped like a smooth U. All over Europe, indeed over much of the world, there are identical valleys, but no sign of ice for hundreds or thousands of miles. The Victorian geologists pieced together a picture that was a bit worrying in some ways, but reassuring overall. About 1.6 million years back, at the start of the Pleistocene era, the Earth suddenly became colder. The ice caps at the poles advanced, thanks to a rapid building up of snow, and gouged out those U-shaped valleys. Then the ice retreated again. Four times in all, it was thought, the ice had advanced and retreated, with much of Europe being buried under a layer of ice several miles thick. Still, there was no need to worry, the geologist said. We seemed to be safe and snug in the middle of a warm period, with no prospect of being buried under miles of ice for quite some time. The picture is no longer so comfortable. Indeed, some people think that the greatest threat to humanity is not global warming, but an incipient ice age. How ironic and how undeserved if our pollution of the planet cancels out a natural disaster. As usual, the main reason we now know a lot more is that new kinds of observation became possible, propped up by new theories to explain what it is that they measure, and why we can be reasonably sure that they do. These new methods range from clever methods for dating old rocks to studies of the proportions of different isotopes in cores drilled from ancient ice, backed up by ocean drilling to study the layers of sediment deposited on the sea floor. Warm seas sustain different living creatures, whose death deposits different sediment, so there is a link from sediments to climate. All of these methods reinforce each other and lead to very much the same picture. Every so often, the surface of the Earth begins to cool, becoming 10 to 15 degrees C colder near the poles and 5 degrees C colder elsewhere. Then, it suddenly warms up, possibly becoming 5 degrees C warmer than the current norm. In between big fluctuations, there are smaller ones, mini ice ages. The typical gap between a decent-sized ice age and the next is around 75,000 years, often less. Nothing like the comfortable 400,000 years of interglacial expected by the Victorians. The most worrying finding of all is that periods of high temperatures, that is, like we get now, seldom lasted more than 20,000 years. The last major glaciation ended 18,000 years ago. Wrap up well, folks. What caused the ice ages? It turns out that the Earth isn't quite as nice a planet as we like to think, and its orbit round the Sun isn't quite as stable and repetitive as we usually assume. The current accepted theory was devised in 1920 by a Serbian called Milutin Milankovic. In broad terms, the Earth goes round the Sun in an ellipse, almost a circle, but there are three features of the Earth's motion that change. One is the amount through which the Earth's axis tilts, about 23 degrees at the moment, but varying slightly in a cycle that lasts roughly 41,000 years. Another is a change in the position of Earth's closest approach to the Sun, which varies in a 20,000-year cycle. The third is a variation in the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit, how oval it is, whose period is around 100,000 years. Putting all three cycles together, it is possible to calculate the changes in heat received from the Sun. These calculations agree with the known variations in the Earth's temperature, and it seems particularly likely that the Earth's warming up after ice ages is due to increased warmth from the Sun, thanks to these three astronomical cycles. It may seem unsurprising that when the Earth receives more heat from the Sun, it warms up, and when it doesn't, it cools down. But not all of the heat that reaches the upper atmosphere gets down to the ground. It can be reflected by clouds, and even if it gets to ground level, it can be reflected from the oceans and from snow and ice. It is thought that during ice ages, this reflection causes the Earth to lose more heat than it would otherwise do, so ice ages automatically make themselves worse. We get kicked out of them when the incoming heat from the Sun is so great that the ice starts to melt, despite the lost heat. Or maybe the ice gets dirty, or it's not so clear that we get kicked into an ice age when less of the Sun's warmth reaches the Earth. Indeed, the slide into an ice age is usually more gradual than the climb back out of it. All of which makes one wonder whether global warming caused by gases excreted from animals might be partly responsible. When gases such as carbon dioxide and methane build up in the atmosphere, they cause the famous greenhouse effect, trapping more sunlight than usual, hence more heat. Right now, most scientists have become convinced, the Earth's supply of greenhouse gases is growing faster than it would otherwise do, thanks to human activities such as farming, burning rainforest to clear land, driving cars, burning coal and oil for electricity, and farming again. Cows produce a lot of methane. Grass goes in one end, and methane emerges at the other. And how could we forget the carbon dioxide breathed out by people? One person is equivalent to half a car, maybe more. Maybe in the past there were vast civilizations of which we now know nothing, all traces having vanished, except for their effect on the global temperature. Maybe the Earth seethed with vast herds of cattle, buffalo, elephants, busily excreting methane. But most scientists think that climate change results from variations in five different factors: the Sun's output of radiant heat, the Earth's orbit, the composition of the atmosphere, the amount of dust produced by volcanoes, and levels of land and oceans resulting from movement of the Earth's crust. We can't yet put together a really coherent picture in which the measurements match the theory as closely as we'd like, but one thing that is becoming clear is that the Earth's climate has more than one equilibrium state. It stays in or near one such state for a while, then switches comparatively rapidly to another, and so on. The original idea was that one state was a warm climate, like the one we have now, and the other was a cold ice age one. In 1998, Didier Payard refined this idea to a three-state model: interglacial, warm; mild glacial, coldish; and glacial, very cold. A drop in heat received from the Sun below some critical threshold caused by those astronomical cycles triggers a switch from warm to coldish. When the resulting ice builds up sufficiently, it reflects so much of the Sun's heat that this triggers another switch from coldish to very cold. But when the Sun's heat finally builds up again to another threshold value, thanks once more to the three astronomical cycles, then the climate switches back to warm. This model fits observations deduced from the amount of oxygen-18, a radioactive isotope of oxygen, in geological deposits. Finally, some drama. About 700 million years ago, there was an ice age so severe that it very nearly killed off all of the surface life on Earth. This big freeze lasted for between 10 and 20 million years. The ice reached the equator, and it seems that the seas froze to a depth of half a mile, 1 kilometer or more. According to the snowball Earth theory proposed by Paul Hoffman and Daniel Schrag in 1998, ice covered the entire Earth at this time. However, if ice really covered the whole Earth, it should have done more damage than the fossil record indicates. And that's not the only problem. One key piece of evidence for the Big Freeze is a layer of sedimentary rock that formed just after the glaciers melted and left huge quantities of debris. This layer contains less carbon-13 in proportion to ordinary carbon-12 than normal. Marine photosynthesis converts carbon-12 into carbon dioxide more readily than it does carbon-13, so an excess of carbon-13 is left behind in seawater and in the layers of sediment in it that later turn to rock. So a low ratio of carbon-13 to carbon-12 indicates low biological activity. The scientists' task is to find ways to try to disprove things that seem to make sense. In 2001, Martin Kennedy and Nicholas Christie Blick measured this ratio for sediments that formed during the alleged Big Freeze. If the world was miles deep in ice, the ratio ought to be low. But in fact, it was high in Africa, Australia, and North America. This suggests that the global ecosystem was going strong at that time. Computer models of the climate system show that the oceans strongly resist freezing over completely too. Like many attractive scientific theories, Snowball Earth is not at all clear-cut, and further research will be needed to find out who is right. Maybe Earth wasn't a really solid snowball after all, or maybe, as Schrag responded, there were patches of open water big enough to change the carbon chemistry of the ocean as it absorbed atmospheric carbon dioxide. Maybe the Earth's axis tilted a lot more than astronomers are willing to concede, and the poles lost their ice while equatorial regions gained it. Or perhaps continental drift was more rapid at that time than we think, and we've mapped out the extent of the ice incorrectly. Whatever the details, though, it was a spectacularly icy world. Although the Big Freeze came close to wiping out all surface life, it may indirectly have created a lot of today's biodiversity. The big shift from single-celled creatures to multi-celled ones also happened 800 million years ago. It is plausible that the Big Freeze cleared away a lot of the single-celled life forms and opened up new possibilities for multi-celled life, culminating in the Cambrian explosion 540 million years ago. Mass extinctions are typically succeeded by sudden bursts of diversity, in which life reverts from being a professional at the evolutionary game to being an amateur. It then takes a while for the less able amateurs to be eliminated, and until they are, all sorts of strange strategies for making a living can temporarily thrive. The succession of icy periods that followed the Big Freeze could only have assisted this process. However, it may have been the other way round. The invention of the anus by triploblasts may have changed the ecology of the seas. Feces would have dropped to the seabed, where bacteria could specialize in breaking them down. Other organisms could then become filter feeders, living on those bacteria, perhaps sending their larvae up into the plankton for dispersal, as modern filter feeders do. Several new ways of life depended on this primeval composting system, and it's possible that the successful return of phosphorus and nitrogen into the marine cycles led to an explosion of algae, which reduced atmospheric carbon dioxide, cut back on the greenhouse effect, and triggered the Big Freeze. Fortunately for us, the Big Freeze wasn't quite long enough or cold enough to kill off everything. Bacteria in volcanic vents on the ocean floor and in the Earth's crust would have survived no matter what, but evolution would have been set back a long, long way. So when the Earth warmed, life exploded into a fresh, competition-free world. Paradoxically, a major reason why we are here today may be that we very nearly weren't. Our entire evolutionary history is full of these good news, bad news scenarios, where life leaps forward joyously over the bodies of the fallen. Rincewind can be forgiven for feeling that Roundworld has it in for him. Life has suffered from many different kinds of natural disaster. Here are two more. In the Permian-Triassic extinction of 250 million years ago, 96% of all species died within the space of a few hundred thousand years. To the best of our knowledge, based on deduction from the available evidence. Certainly it was a big extinction, far bigger than the one that killed off or helped to kill off the dinosaurs. We remember the dinosaur one because they've had such good PR people. William Hopster and Mordecai Magaritz think this happened because they suffocated. Carbon isotopes show that a lot of coal and shale oxidized in the run-up to the extinction, probably because of a fall in sea level, which exposed more land. The result was a lot more carbon dioxide and a lot less oxygen, which was reduced to half today's level. Land species were especially badly affected. Another global extinction, though less severe, occurred 55 million years ago, the Paleocene-Eocene boundary. In cores of sediment drilled from the Antarctic, James Kennett and Lowell Scott discovered evidence of the sudden death of a lot of marine species. It seems that trillions of tons of methane had burst from the ocean, sending temperatures through the roof, methane being a powerful greenhouse gas. Jenny Dickens suggested that the methane was released from deposits of methane hydrates in permafrost and on the seabed. Methane hydrates are a crystal lattice of water enclosing methane gas. They are created when bacteria in mud release the gas, and it becomes trapped. Coincidentally, one of the main results of the Paleocene-Eocene extinction was a burst of evolutionary diversity, leading in particular to the higher primates and us. Whether something is a disaster depends on your point of view. Rocks may not have a point of view, as Ponder Stibbins pointed out, but we certainly do.